Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Happy to be joined today by Josh Blank, research director of the Texas Politics Project. Other than haggling over poll items, how are you this morning, Josh?
I'm doing pretty okay. I'm fed, so it's okay.
I'm fed. You know, there's nothing really that chorizo, potato, and egg tacos can't, like, just absorb.
I'm fine. Yeah, exactly.
In any number of ways. All right. So we should start off script already.
Yeah,
but
great.
As we go on the – as we came on the air today, the House leadership – Speaker's office released the committee assignments for the House. You know, we got those about 45 minutes ago. I don't want to try to go out on a limb here, but you know, at first cut, people that seemed aligned with the speaker seem to have done pretty well.
Yeah.
Not to be, you know, to be expected. You know, if you follow these things, you know, you'll notice, you know, people can look at, you know, what changed and what didn't. Chairman Bonin is still Chairman Bonin of the Appropriations Committee. I think it would have been a really big surprise was that not the case.
Right.
You know, a little bit of a moving around of some of the other big committees. Todd Hunter moves from State Affairs to Calendars,
right,
where he has been before, I believe. State Affairs is going to taken over by Ken King. Mm-hmm. Brad Buckley, still chair of the Education Committee in the House, where there's obviously going to be a lot of action.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, at first glance, I'm sure, you know, people that have softer eyes than I do on this have looked at this and started pointing things out.
And there's some things that we've pointed out that we're not going to go over here.
Right,
yet.
Exactly. And but we'll look at that more, and I'm sure that will come up again probably as soon as next week.
Probably. When
you know, I mean, it's worth noting, you know, we've kind of been... I'll say treading water, and it's kind of this, and it kind of brings us back to the setup
for
today.
This is fair.
You know, we've been talking a lot about, you know, what the polling we did in December talked about the agenda. The Senate, of course, is shot out like a, you know, like a ball out of a cannon.
Right.
Whatever. Typically the case under Dan Patrick.
Yeah.
You know, both institutional and political reasons for that. But, you know, until, you know, we really needed to get these committee assignments to see. To go, okay, now we're really going.
Well, and the thing is I think it's really, I'm just going to torture the analogy. You know, you see the ball get shot out of the cannon, it's really easy to jump on the ball and say, where are we going? Before you realize, like, well, there's this whole other institution they have to set up. And that's the, when we say we've been treading water, it's because, you know, to be fair and to be an observer of this, it's easy to kind of jump in and say, okay, this is what's happening.
Yeah.
This is what the voucher plan looks like. This is what the priorities are. But that's actually the political process playing out, is these various actors and factions trying to make that the agenda. We have to let all the players, you know, again, put the pieces on the board, see what happens, and then we can start to actually assess what's going to
happen. Yeah, and that tendency,
proceed, you know,
the tendency to jump prematurely on that overinterpret, as you're saying, is exactly right. And also, you know, it also underlines, you know, where people have these institutional advantages at one moment or the next.
That's right.
And underlines, you know, one of the many payoffs of Lieutenant Governor Patrick's ability to, you know, solidify, to understate the case, his control over the Senate.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You know, translates into a big influence on the agenda. So given all that, you know, after we've, you know, today I thought we'd have something of a big picture question day, and we'll see how that goes.
Yeah.
That can sometimes be great and sometimes less, but we'll see.
We'll find out by the end.
Yes, and we'll know in 45 minutes or a couple hours, whatever. And focus on a theme that has come up a lot, and that's the question of the nationalization of Texas politics.
Yeah.
And
this feels like a good time to have this discussion in some ways, even though it's almost harder.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and in some ways, we've been having that discussion in a lot of ways this morning, I think. You know, and like I said, you know, in the last few weeks, we bounced back and forth, you know, borderline repetitive, looking at Texas public opinion and the still unfolding agenda of the Trump-Musk administration and what's bubbling under in the legislature, which, as we've said, we've had to wait for. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I do think that, you know, what I kind of want to pick at a little bit today, and without too much expectation of resolving this, you know, I'm thinking of it as kind of reconnaissance in force, maybe.
Yeah.
Who knows? Maybe we'll wander into something more clear, direct. But, you know, lurking adjacent to these discussions is this more macro level question mm-hmm. about how, you know, an increasingly, you know, loud and present national politics and all kinds of things, and we'll unpack some of this, you know, has affected Texas politics. And I think usually when people talk about this, you know, nobody thinks it's a good thing. Let's put it that way. It's never right. presented it's, as a yeah. good thing, right? It's always either just a thing that somebody is observing or it's a bad thing. And yeah. we can talk about different examples of that. But it's now like a very persistent trope for both, you know, how we understand state politics and you know, how from moment to moment we make sense of current events, but also, you know, kind of the overall arc of the state's recent history. And, you know, just to put a little, you know, that all sounds kind of pretty airy-fairy, and I realize that, but, you know, you can put a little meat on the bone here. I mean, for, you know, for a long time, it played in a negative kind of way. That is, you know, how many times have we heard, particularly in the House, but until recently in the Senate, but you also hear it in the Senate. Actually, Lieutenant Governor Patrick uses this too. You know, the comparison that, you know, Texas, you know, is not like the rest of the country. Right. In our politics, you know, we know how to get things done. We're not paralyzed like Washington, D.C. Right. We're not so polarized. You know, all of these things. And
something just to throw out here.
Yeah.
There is no institution in society that gets lower approval ratings than the U.S. Congress.
Right. And so,
it's, you know, easy enough to say, hey, we don't want to be like them.
It's an easy foil.
Yeah. Not only do we not want to be like them, we're not. Right.
Okay. You know, and yet.
Yeah. And yet.
It would be foolish to try to understand what's going on in Texas politics without some taking into account, you know, some notion of how the, you know, in a more political science-y way, the parties have become mm-hmm. more homogenous, more sorted, more nationalized, and that trickles down and shapes right. state politics.
Yes.
You know, and in fact, now, in the opposite direction, and it, you know, to be fair, we saw this somewhat in the Biden administration, but not as much in Texas, is, you know, the idea that this is our national model, this is what we should be doing, we should be doing this here too. And we'll
right.
unpack lots of examples of that. But, you know, this tension between, you know, what is organic to the state's politics, how much of this is following the country, how those two,
yeah,
you know, what the feedback loop is, which yeah. is, you know, the mature way of thinking about it. It's like, yeah, it's going to be a little
well,
low.
Well, and that's where I'm kind of feeling.
Right.
Because part of what happens is you get these sorts of questions from time to time to talk about the nationalization of state politics, or just not nationalization of politics anyway, generally. And I think, you know, someone focused so closely on Texas, it always strikes you a little bit funny because it's just not—it's not a one-way street. As I think that's right. exactly the point here, and it's not a one-way street at any specific point in time. But also the flow of that traffic, if you will,
yeah.
is dependent on a lot of other factors, you know, yeah. over time and space, right?
Yeah.
You know,
and morning rush hour and the evening rush hour are kind of different.
Yeah, who's in the White House right yeah. now? What party's in control of the Congress? You know, are we in a legislative yeah. session or are we not in a legislative session? Right? Plus sort of just the yeah. generic.
How popular is the president at the time?
What are
how
the
much have they solidified their base or opposition
What
to
are
them?
The migration flows right now?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, so there's all these kinds of factors that influence, again, I think the flow on those streets. But at least from us, like, look at this, like, but it's a flow. And at different points in time, it's going in both directions. And so this whole kind of like, well, top-down nationalization of state politics. But at the same time, here we are sitting, you know, in the first few weeks of the Trump administration. And I think, you know, you're sort of joking about us kind of, you know, whatever, birthing another polling instrument. And this one's a little bit more difficult. And we knew it would be, right?
Yeah.
And part of it is because, you know, Trump is such an active force in politics. And so I think, you know, that's another sort of thing that layers over this question
right.
here is that as Trump is so active in this space, it's hard to sort of say, well, you know, wait a minute, it's not all one way.
Yeah, and had such a successful takeover of the party.
Right.
That, you know, and then, you know, but then I'm also like very leery as, you know, many know probably that I've been on panels with, you know, every time somebody stands up and goes, well, let's just talk about how what's going on in national politics, everybody's really just following Texas because we're leading the way.
Right.
You know, and that's also, you know, there you can find examples of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's what's crazy about that, again, I'll just say, like, being not from Texas. So I have no
yeah.
stake in that argument that, you know, sort of so goes Texas, so goes the nation. However, there are instances, and we'll pick them
right.
out here, where you do see Texas really pushing the national discussion, pushing politics in really notable consequential ways from the bottom up.
Right.
And people don't seem to like actually, I mean, in a lot of ways, there are very few people who really try to grasp and wrestle with that piece of this puzzle as much as they try to do the other, which is the nationalization.
And I think your openness to that has a lot to do with, you know, I mean, you're talking about how you don't have a dog in the fight. Look, a lot of people we interact with that, you know, we're in public appearances with, we're talking to reporters, even, you know, academics to a lesser degree. You know, there are people that are invested in going, yeah, you know, Texas is really important.
Yeah.
And I know all about Texas, and so...
Yeah, I mean, listen, I'm down. I'm here. Right. I know a lot about Texas, and if we all want to agree, it's really important.
Right, and so I you know, and I'm always a little, you know, I often am a little resistant to that. Now, sometimes it's just the source, I guess, and the mode of delivery, you know, but... So, I you know, all of which is to say there's a lot of different threads, you know, that are woven in and figuring this out, and just to step back, you know, to have the politics in the state become more nationalized, how do we know that? If so, in what way? What are the consequences? And again, as we started, for years, we've just been hearing about not wanting the Texas legislature to be like the dysfunctional U.S. Congress. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it feels to me like we're not hearing that quite as much anymore from, you know, and again, right now that both, you know, got the same party dominating institutions in the state. Right. I don't want to be an idiot about this. Of course, we're not hearing about it as much.
Right.
But there's always been a sense, I think, in which there was some friction that even when there was a same party thing,
well, you know, I mean, when,
you know, there was, you know, parallel party control that, you know, people were still, there's still this element in Texas of people saying, well, you know, we're just not going to be like them. We all get along. And part of that was also very mythic.
I'm saying that, and I think that impulse is obviously, I mean, whether this is national politics, local, you know, state politics, bottom up, top down, or whatever, that impulse is obviously weaker than it was even a few sessions ago to where we are now. And I would say, you know, I keep thinking, you know, at least at the national level in terms of the sort of internal dynamics, you know, the sort of the big event is giving, you know, again, essentially one member in the Congress the ability to sort of put up a motion to vacate the chair or whatever, right? You know, whatever the language is, the congressional level. And it was sort of like, you know, it's like, it's almost like, you know, but for the grace of God, go Texas. Because the same dynamics in terms of, you know, the coalitional dynamics that we're playing out in Congress are a lot of the same dynamics we're actually seeing in Texas. It's just that, you know, the body has not essentially inflicted that kind of a wound on itself that's led to this sort of uber level of dysfunction at the congressional level.
They've danced on the edge of it a couple times.
Very close. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So that, you know, that kind of, and it clears the brush, but it drags all the brush into the middle.
Yeah.
All right.
You're gonna light it on fire.
So let's, you know, let's unpack this a little more. So let's go about this in a, you know, there's a couple different ways we can do this, I think. So, you know, let's just start from the obvious point here, like that we both made, that you made very well, I think. You know, this isn't a binary, right? We're not going to, like, you know, the goal here isn't to go, okay, no, they are nationalized or they're not nationalized.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be an easier question, I think, if it was that. We know, so, you know, let's start maybe with the signs of national influences, because you've done kind of, you've already kind of started with that a little bit. But, you know, sift through it in a way, like if I was, you know, the cocktail version, if I was to say to you, you know, Josh, what do you think are the signs of the nationalization of state politics? What are the top couple things on your list?
Yeah, I think, you know, we just kind of went from it, but the operation of the Texas House is one, and sort of this, you know, I think the coalitional politics we're seeing. I mean, to your point, there was sort of this kind of mythic is a strong word, but it's not, you know, incorrect, and sort of the fact that, like, Texas did a little bit differently, you know, and then, like, yeah, it's a conservative state, but, you know, Democrats and Republicans come together on a lot of things. You know, there's rural Democrats out there who, you know, again, they'll still say this. I mean, they actually still exist. They'll say, hey, you know, they have large rural communities. Like, we're still working on the same stuff. And I think, you know, to the extent that politics has become more zero sum at the national level, you're seeing that influence the way that people play politics in Texas more and more.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you brought this, I'll just bring it up. We have a question that we ask regularly about whether or not voters think that essentially their party should compromise or stand on principle when it comes to political conflict. Like, you know, what should we see? And overall, interestingly enough, it's basically split. In December, 51% of Texans said compromise, 49% said stand on principle. But historically, we've asked this question since 2015, so we've asked this a bunch of times. Usually, the majority of Democrats will say compromise, and it's ranged between about 60 and 75%, but it's come down in recent years from that high level. Republicans, normally a majority, will say stand on principle. Again, sort of similar, between 60 and 70%. And it's come down over the last couple of years more a little bit towards 60. So both, I mean, in some sense, both sides have moderated a little bit.
Yeah.
But I do think, you know, there is this sense now, and I don't necessarily want to attach everything to Trump because that becomes kind of a one-sided thing.
Right.
But I do think that there is something about the way that Trump has approached politics and this notion of you should expect 100% of what you're asking for, and it's okay to walk away if you don't get the perfect deal. I think that has actually had a downward effect on the way that politics is practiced. And even that, I think, is too simple, because if you say, like, well, is it all downward? No, because there are obviously people down at the grass tops level mostly who see that and say, oh, you know, I can use this to mobilize from the bottom up,
right,
and create, you know, sort of the same set of expectations. So that's the, like, the one kind of big, you know, really airy-fairy, artsy-fartsy one I see. You know, more specifically, when I think about top-down stuff, I think the recent focus on DEI is, like, really noticeable. I mean, in the sense that we know from polling, this is not something that was on top of mind for a lot of people. As recently, honestly, as, like, last year, you know, in the last couple of years, Trump is really pushed this both sort of in his campaign, but especially since taking office. And it's hard not to look at that and see how many times Greg Abbott referenced DEI in his State of the State speech. You know, you'd almost be forgiven for wondering if Texas was like California. Like, there's so many DEI policies going on, like in all these state institutions and stuff. Like, Texas is this, you know, really progressive.
Right. Drowning in DEI.
We're just drowning in DEI here. Yeah. And it's like, okay, but, you know, I can see that. You know, I think the whole focus that we're seeing in Texas now on government efficiency is really interesting. Again, you know, this is a low taxes, low services state that Republicans have been in charge of for the last 20 years. It'd be shocking if they can find a lot of waste, fraud, and abuse to extract from the Texas system. But that's clearly a reflection of trying to mirror this sort of national, you know, discussion, even though even that, I think, again, doing that's something that's been around.
As I recall, they were sort of ordered to do so.
Yeah, and that's also, but that's also been around. You know, I mean, you could say this is not like a new Republican priority, right? I mean, this has existed for decades.
It's
and decades.
A new, you know, I mean, I think it's a new vehicle and umbrella concept.
Right.
Right, which I think, you know, we were, you know, talking about putting a poll together, which, you know, we've had to grapple with.
Right.
I mean, the degree to which something that evolves as an umbrella concept, you know, you should replicate that in the language, right? Because you want to test the response to the language, but you also don't want the language to drive the responses.
Right. We're not, you know, we're not testing poll-tested ideas. That's the goal here, you know. And then I think obviously the one that I'm leaving out is the most obvious, but it's also probably one of the most complicated, is sort of immigration and border security in terms of sort of the specifics, in the sense that, you know, yes, the state and you know, we can talk about bottom-up stuff and the way that the state has actually influenced the national discussion. However, the state's orientation, its public orientation, if not its specific policy recently, is very much determined by, you know, who's in control of the national level. You know, control of the White House has shifted from Joe Biden to Donald Trump. Texas's overall dynamic now at the state level is you know, the conversation is a very different one, and that's just a totally has to do with what's going on at the national level now. And but again, even that's like probably actually the most complicated in some
way. But it's a perfect transition, right? Because, you know, I mean, the immigration border security thing has been percolating here for a long time.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, I mean, this really speaks to the, you know, a piece we wrote. I think we wrote it a couple times in 2015 and then again in 2017 or 18 or so. You know, one of the titles of one of those pieces was, you know, essentially, let's not forget Texas was Trumpy before Trump.
Right.
And that, you know, in terms of, the, you know, in immigration and border security, and to some extent the DEI thing, I think really like land right in the middle of that.
Yeah.
Right. The degree to which, you know, Trump both exploited and pumped up certain aspects of things that were here. But then, you know, because, you know, he is in a position to amplify those impulses and is very much a, you know, top-down governance kind of guy, I think it's safe to say at this point.
It would seem so.
You know, I mean, you know, the feedback loop there gets really just jolted.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, so, you know, which sends, you know, leads us to ask then, for the sake, you know, in an abstract way, what's the argument for giving, you know, more consideration to the persistence of, you know, however we're going to conceptualize it, bottom up, influence of Texas, organic, you know, the organic factors that shape the trajectory of politics in the state, you know, what is the determinative influence of Texas specific things? And, you know, we have to remember that this is, you know, not to be thinking about government 310 or something, but the complexity here is a function of the system of government.
Right.
Right. We've got a small D Democratic, small R Republican federal system. You know, institutional design is part of what's making this complicated. And it's also part of, though, what guarantees to my mind that there's always going to be some bottom up, right? Something, you know, from the states that are going to be flowing up and shaping national politics. But, you know, also with the assumption that there is going to be, again, this feedback loop, right? So this tends to help fuel this kind of idea, the, you know, the frequent kind of trope you see that, you know, Texas is always behind the big ideas that take root nationally. You see that a lot from state-based journalists, I think, and from political entrepreneurs in the state.
I mean,
like the governor. But I don't know, you know, I think we have to kind of look at that in a way, you know, that is a little bit more sensitive to the broader trajectory of time here, right? I mean, look, right now, we are in a moment of intensely nationalized politics,
mm-hmm.
right? Because of the magnitude of the Republican victory in 2024, but in a longer term sense, just once again, you know, the impact of, you know, Donald Trump's view of governing and leadership.
Right.
And I can't believe I even uttered that sentence because I'm not sure exactly how articulated that is, but how he manages that.
Right.
Right. And, you know, that is bound to be a little bit of a recursive issue.
Yeah.
But I mean, I guess the thing that I just can't like get the bit out on is conversations that we had a lot during Trump's rise. There was a certain kind of, on one hand, there were certain stylistic and norm busting things about Trump and mm-hmm. his reception in Texas and his impact on the party system here that were about Trump.
Right.
But at the time, we commented a lot about the fact that, like, you know, this is not happening in a vacuum in a state like Texas where, you know, in another sense, you might say, you know, other than the geographic cultural differences, Trump's a pretty good fit, right, for the kind of ideological tenor and the kind of roots of – and even a very, you know, the kind of more populist Western part of Texas conservatism.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when I want to like simplify in a way sort of a lot of the conflict that's taken place in the Texas legislature in the last, you know, decade and a half around leadership, you know, one of the things that I kind of go back to as a touchstone is this notion of, you know, 10 or now, you know, 15 years ago, there was an idea that seemed to impact the leadership in Texas that said, you know, we don't really want to take like a vote on banning abortion on the Texas floor. It's just not really good politics for us. We're going to end up in a lawsuit. You know, yes, we, you know, we know how we're going to happen.
Well, I would just note that took place. That was rooted even farther
back. I can only go back as far as I can, right? But that was like, I experienced that sense of like, yeah, we don't want to take a vote on allowing everybody to carry a gun everywhere. It just doesn't seem like good politics. Yes, I know that, you know, my primary constituency expects me to vote a certain way on it. And this was kind of the thing that I think elites were pointing out, this disconnect between sort of what some politicians saw as good, you know, overall politics for the state versus, you know, what would happen if they were forced to actually make a vote on these things. And Trump pushes more of that stuff out into the open, kind of saying like, you know, and the stuff that he's saying is not wildly outside of the mainstream of the Republican Party, usually, and especially of, you know, of the activist universe on a lot of this stuff. It's just that, you know, people say he's saying the quiet part out loud. And now it forces other people to, you know, again, other Republicans to take account. And if you sort of talk to, you know, a lot of staffers, especially who work for Republicans in Texas, say it's a lot easier working with a Democrat in the White House because you just shoot straight, right?
Right.
Whereas with Trump, you're kind of following him. Now, the flip side of this, I would say, is, you know, so on some extent, you know, it makes Texas even more reactive to kind of not just the whims of Trump, but also, I think, the undercurrents within the party that, you know, ultimately the party's trying to manage in a system that requires, you know, majoritarian support,
right
to work. And then at the same time, though, you know, to your point, sort of this is kind of the other side of this, which is like, well, Texas is the leader. It's like, Texas is unique, right? In the sense that you've got this huge state. It's got a huge international border. It's got five huge metropolitan areas, six if you want to include El Paso as well, which is not huge, but the other ones are huge by any standard, any country. You've got a modern, diverse, young state, and yet a very small conservative form of government. So naturally, you know, this is something we also say to reporters, like, Texas is part of the United States. And so these conversations, these currents are going on at the national level are certainly going to impact Texas. But also, this is why Texas can be a leader in some of these things too, because in some ways, Texas is dealing with everything that everybody else is dealing with, but like a little bit more or a lot more of it.
Right. And there's, you know, there's this laboratory of, you know, laboratories of democracy / laboratories of autocracy, depending right. on what book you're reading this week. You know, that is part of the base of this, right? That's part of, you know, that doesn't really go away. And as you say, because of Texas's size and economic and population heft, mm-hmm. we talk a lot about how the rural population is shrinking, but the raw numbers of the rural population is still
bigger, you know, than bigger than like 12 or 14 other states'
populations.
Bigger
than a bunch of states, right? Yeah. So, mm-hmm. you know, and that, you know, to be a little more generous with the Texas is a leader thing. I mean, there are reasons why that are very concrete, why when Texas adopts policies, other, you know, like the textbook thing, well, it's a big market.
Yeah.
For example.
Well, or when Texas closes its border, it's going to impact overland trade right. pretty dramatically. And I think what the governor has shown too is like, look, you know, when the state decides it's going to get creative in the case of busing migrants out of state to yeah. Democratic controlled districts, it ends up changing the national discussion. And it did.
Yeah.
And that was not, and then, I mean, honestly, that had nothing to do with Trump. That had nothing to do with actual national politics. And in fact, that was a clear bottom-up influencing of national politics that changed the yeah. dynamic and the salience of that issue.
And so, you know, that policy, you know, the policy process loop, you know, we do like the state national yeah. overlay. It's kind of interesting there, right, where the feedback comes from, where the, you know, and then in a kind of, in another sense, the kind of party system, you know, political transmission belts sense, the party piece is pretty interesting here in terms of,
very interesting,
you know, like to the extent that this discussion intersects with the discussion of the changes in the parties, which we always bring in mm-hmm. as kind of more independent variable than dependent variable here to be
yeah.
social science-y half-assedly in a way. You know, I guess I was, as you were talking, I was playing out this thing in my head going, okay, so say Donald Trump doesn't win the 2016 primary.
Yeah.
Right. And Trump doesn't take over the Republican Party.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you know.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, I don't even,
you
know what you're
asking. Philip Roth, you know.
No, but
we're in Philip Roth territory here a little bit, but, or reverse Philip Roth, I guess. But, and to me, that's what highlights the thing that it's kind of the rub for me. It's like.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's an interesting way to put it.
You know, Dan Patrick was already in the Senate.
Yep.
Was already lieutenant governor.
Yeah.
And was, frankly, career trajectory wise, you know, had a few similarities to Trump. I mean, he mm-hmm. wasn't trying to convince people he was a multi-billionaire, but, you know, roots in media,
yep.
et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, a very raw populist appeal that, you know, very similar to what Trump does. I mean, it's not, you know, no offense, lieutenant governor, but if, you know, you're going to put it on the volume dial, Trump turns it up to 11 a la Spinal Tap. Dan Patrick turned it up to, you know, 7 or 8 at a time when most people were, the most prominent politicians assumed that 4 or 5 was about where you wanted to be.
You know, it's funny you make that comparison because it makes me think back to the debates in both of those races, you know.
Right.
And it's almost like, and it's not the same. Again, it's a different volume level. But I mean, if you watch the limited debates for that lieutenant governor's race in the primary, not the general, in the primary, it was sort of shocking. And at the time, seeing Sir Dan Patrick basically took out a position sort of pretty far to the right of the people that the people were willing to take on the stage.
And again, on border security and immigration was the key issue
yeah,
there.
Threw up like, and on abortion, actually, threw up his hand and said, yeah, count me in. Anybody else want to come?
Yeah.
And it was kind of like, oh, and they were kind of like, I guess. And that was sort of the same thing. I mean, it was yeah. a lot, and in that, again, 2016 Republican primary for president, it was a lot of just sort of trying to figure out how to deal with Trump on the stage taking these positions. I was, yeah. I mean, you know, going back
his trouncing of Dewhurst, you know, his punishment of Dewhurst was very similar to what Trump serially did with his more institutional rivals in the 2016 primary.
Yeah, I would say even with Cruz. I mean, if you think about it, Cruz was going to that election thinking, you know, nobody's going to outflank me on immigration. And then Trump came along and said, watch.
Yeah,
and he did, and that was kind of. And I would say, you know, at the time, it was hard to imagine anybody, you know, outflanking Cruz on immigration stuff, and Trump did it, and
yeah.
I mean, it was sort of. It's, you know, it's interesting that you bring it up this way, because I mean, there is something about this that it sort of makes me think about the whole concept of this nationalization and bottom up, top down. It's sort of like, to me, like, I guess where I go is just sort of as a public opinion person, it just sort of brings me back to something which is like, you know, you can't be successful telling people what to think.
Yeah.
You know, and so ultimately there is going to be a kernel of something organic in all of this, right? And you know, I've said this, you know, probably too many times, but you know, when Trump came down the escalator and did that speech, you know, my initial thought was like, it's almost like he's looking at our polling in Texas.
Yeah.
I mean, the way that he's talking about these issues and the way that what he's choosing to focus on, it's just, I mean, it would be perfect for this group. And part of it is to be an effective communicator in that this kind of level, you need to communicate things to people usually that they already believe in some kind of way. And so that's part of that sort of the idea that like this is all kind of top down or bottom up or whatever. It's like, no, I think Trump has been more successful at mobilizing views that a lot of people already hold and being willing to express views that a good number of people already hold, even if they're uncomfortable about.
Right.
And I think one of the things that, you know, a lot of people have had difficulty dealing with at various levels is this notion that, well, yeah, but you can't express that view and not turn off all these other people. But, you know, if we go back to work that we've been doing here for, you know, a long time now, I mean, one of the first things that I think, you know, not one of the first things, one thing that we spent a lot of time on was this notion of like kind of erstwhile, like sort of Tea Party supporters or Republicans in the, you know, the party who didn't support the Tea Party or they didn't identify as a Tea Party.
They didn't identify, but what we found out was that ultimately, if they didn't want to identify with the Tea Party, they still agreed with
the influence the most they salient, had,
with the positions that the Tea Party was trying to make salient, particularly as the Tea Party evolved beyond its initial anti-tax,
Yeah, and when we'd say, like, do they have enough influence, too much, too little, and the non-Tea Party Republicans would usually say, yeah, it's about right.
Yeah.
It's fine. And so I think, you know, there's that's probably still going on here, too, in a way that's interesting. I think it's tough for people to understand and sort of, you know, I think make square with all this. But I mean, it goes back to this piece, which is, you know, this can't be one way or the other, because ultimately the people who are successful are the ones who are mobilizing what some non-static majority or near majority or near voting majority of the public or of the primary electorate thinks on these issues.
Right.
And so there, it can't be one way all the time, you know.
Yeah. Right? And look, I mean, not to over-reduce it, but I think, you know, before, you know, if we look back at what people thought was, you know, the hallmark of the ability of Texas elected officials, including in the legislature, to cooperate across party lines, there's an argument to be made that that was much more of an elite phenomena that was working to suppress those real differences among the population. And that, and look, that's what a lot of the, you know, the grassroots right and the grassroots left have made that argument.
Right.
Over the years, right? When the Democrats were in control, there were, you know, the liberal and progressive wing of the party became increasingly vocal about saying, you know, our elected officials are not doing enough.
Right.
They are compromising too much. For years, it was within the party as the Republicans regained more traction again, finally. It became about those compromises during that transition. And it's funny because I think, again, this is a little oversimplified, but from the elite perspective, you know, I think I've brought it up on the podcast before. I think about the event that we did with Bill Ratliff and Pete Laney after they had been acting lieutenant governor and speaker of the House, respectively, during which, in retrospect, was clearly a transitional period between Republican rule and Democratic rule. Mm-hmm. And there's a video on our YouTube account, which is now much more active, where, they're, you know, they call it, and people still refer to it this way in print, as the golden age of Texas politics. But, you know, one could look at that in a different way and say, sure, you know, however you think about that. That was the period of, you know, what you're talking about, protecting members from controversial votes on these, you know, these kinds of issues. But the thing to remember is, you know, we think of that now as kind of protecting Republican members from going too far. That was also a matter of protecting the remaining rural Democrats who didn't want to take those votes. All those people are now Republicans.
Right.
Most of them
are gone.
Yeah, are gone. But that, you know, that dynamic does feel like it was a very top-down management issue. And that argument is still going on. It's going on. It was going on in the last speaker's race.
Right. I mean, we just looked at the committee assignments and, you know, and it's hard not to look at it. I mean, like for me and whatever, you know, one of the things that stands out is say, hey, so like a lot of the people who were chairs, like literally going back 10 years are still chairs.
Yeah.
Which tells you something about, you know, kind of, you know, control and power.
Right. And, you know, and what the dynamic is there. And I think that, I guess the point I'm trying to make is if you look at that in terms of what public opinion is and elections are telling us about where we started, the increasing kind of ideological homogeneity of the two parties mm-hmm. as more clearly defined ideologically driven parties of a certain, you know, a left party and a right party rather than a coalition party trying to bring those areas in and hug the middle.
Right.
But I think, you know, there was a demand, there was some demand brewing for that in factions of the party that institutions were working to diffuse. Mm-hmm. And we're hearing the arguments now, whether that was good
right.
or whether it was bad.
Yeah.
But that was a very state level dynamic that is now being, you know, fueled and kind of reconfigured, you know, by these powerful national forces. And we've kind of, you know, at some point we need to kind of think about how to put these in buckets.
Yeah, I mean, there's a normative thing around this really interesting. And I'd also say, you know, part of the, again, where the national, where the Congress has gone in response to this and where Texas has gone in response to this are not necessarily the same places at this right. point. But what's interesting to note is that, you know, whereas the Congress has sort of become, let's say, more responsive to, say, Democratic impulses, whatever you want to call it, right?
Small D Democratic impulses. You know, popular demands.
That's led to a certain amount of just, you know, essentially dysfunction and sort of, you know, inability to operate. Right. And what's interesting now in the moment we're in right now, and just to sort of, maybe this gets us to an end point in some ways, is watching Donald Trump come in and say, okay, well, you guys can't do this, but you know what? I'm going to do everything I can and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I'm just going to drive this and you guys stop me.
And so what's going to be interesting is to see, you know, in some ways it's, one, what does this legislative session look like? So let's just set that aside because that's a big if condition yeah. here. But, you know, I wonder what are the lessons for Abbott from this?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I will note it's interesting, you know, we did see, I mean, I've kind of been a hobby horse of mine, but there was a campaign finance bill filed by a Republican in the Senate. Pretty interesting, you know? I mean, there's stuff that could be floating around out there, but it's sort of interesting to see, you know, again, top down, bottom up, how that plays out, because it's not like Abbott hasn't been
right.
accumulating power since he took office, as we would have expected him to do. So that we can't say, well, this is Trump because...
Well, but, you know, to close that out, I think I will go back to the legislature, yeah. though, but not so much... I mean, it's about the anticipation of this session, but also, you know, it wasn't that long ago, say the fall of 2023, when everybody was kind of looking at us going into multiple special sessions, mm-hmm. Paxton being impeached, at least in the earlier of those sessions, the legislature having passed a lot of stuff,
yep.
but having a lot of difficulty with what were going to be two signature issues, property tax reform and vouchers, and we heard a lot of this. I mean, that's probably where I had one of my first on stage mm-hmm. discussions about
right.
this nationalization thing. It's like, well, we sure are looking a lot like Washington, D.C. now, aren't we? And look,
even at the end of this podcast, you say that, I take a deep breath.
Yeah, right. You know, but at the same time, you know, it does raise something. It's just, what is the causality there?
Yeah.
And what are the two things? But I, you know, so the question is real. But, you know, as I think I kind of argued with, I think it was sort of panel with Ross at the time, was kind of like, yeah, but yeah, that's what you get,
yeah.
right? I mean, this may look like the national, but, you know, you have to look at this and see that this has been brewing in Texas for a long time,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, and way before the current.
You know, you asked a question a little bit ago,
and it
spurred something, and I think it comes back to this, which is, you know, if Donald Trump hadn't come down that escalator, had the Republicans nominated somebody else, you know, setting aside the specifics of whether that person wins or not or whatever, you know, you can ask yourself, do you think the trajectory of Texas politics would be dramatically different today than what we would have seen? And right now, if my gut says, hard to imagine it being significantly different.
Right. That's a good way of summing it up, right? I mean, I kind of, you know, that's kind of when I was dealing, you know, kind of running through
yeah.
my head at the time, and I've been kind of wrestling with, you know, the underlying structural organic things here. The same thing that makes, you know, the gravity of Texas, in the same way that the gravity of Texas is a reasonable sort of grounds for the argument that, well, you know, you got to follow Texas because we're leaders and we,
yeah.
but it's also a similar ground for the argument that it's always going to have very deeply rooted dynamics of its own, that whatever the national winds are going to blow and, you know,
yeah.
the trees are going to move some, but, you know, the substrate's pretty deep
right.
and pretty heavy here, you
yeah.
know, and I think that's probably what bothers me a little bit about the nationalization argument, even though I, you know, like I said at the beginning, you know, it's a necessary but not sufficient element of figuring out how to explain what's going on here and what seem like very significant changes. All right. Well, you know.
You know, it was all right.
I think that worked all right.
Yeah.
You know, we addressed that okay. We got somewhere.
I think so.
So thanks for guiding us through that and helping muddle through that. Good job, Josh. Thanks to our excellent audio production team in the dev studio of the College of Liberal Arts here at UT Austin. Also want to say one more thing. A little later, we're going to try to go. We want to mark the retirement of friend of the podcast and friend of ours in the Texas Politics Project, Dick Levine, who is marking his retirement. So congratulations to Dick on that. Thanks to you all for listening. You can find polling results, data, analysis at our newly revamped and very accessible website at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. I urge you to go have a look at that. And we'll be back again soon, next week, with another Second Reading Podcast. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.